Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, April 6, 2017, during a live teleform conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's teleform conference call, as today we mark the 25th anniversary of the Lucas case. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and General Counsel and Director of Practice Groups here at the Federal Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We've got three experts with us today. We're going to proceed a little bit differently. We're going to hear first from Professor Eric R. Clays. He's a professor of law at the Antonin Scalia Law School right here in the Washington, D.C. area. We're going to hear first and last from him, actually. He's going to begin with 5 minutes of background. He'll be followed by James S. Burling. Jim Burling is Vice President of Litigation at the Pacific Legal Foundation. He'll speak for 10 minutes, and then we'll hear 10 minutes from Professor Michael A. Wolf. He's the Professor of Law and the Richard E. Nelson Chair in Local Government at the University of Florida Levin College of Law. After that, we'll hear another 5 minutes or so from Professor Eric Clays. So it's Clays, Burling, Wolf, and Clays yet again. But then, as always, we'll be turning to you for audience questions, so please be thinking of those for when we get to that portion of the program. With that, Professor Clays, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Dean. And I volunteered to provide some background on the Lucas case and what came before it. And so to put it in context, maybe it's just best to start with the Takings Clause. The Takings Clause requires that if a government takes property for public use, it needs to provide just compensation. And in the easiest, simple case, the government needs the property to acquire a courthouse, a schoolhouse, or a road, and it acquires title to the property. The Takings Clause has been understood, however, since a case from the 1920s called Mann, that when a government restricts the use or the disposition of property extremely enough, that the restriction on use or the restriction on disposition can inflict a regulatory taking. Before the Lucas case, the major case on regulatory takings was a case called Penn Central versus City of New York. And Penn Central encouraged federal courts, when hearing regulatory takings challenges, to use a balancing approach and to use three factors. One of those factors was to look at how much the economic value of the property that was affected by the regulation dropped as a result of the regulation. The second factor asked how the regulation affected the owner's reasonable and investment-backed expectations. And the third factor asked what kind of character could be given to the purposes that the government acted for when it enforced the regulation. And again, these three factors were balanced in an ad hoc way. And it's possible for people who have claims against the government under a regulatory takings challenge to win under the Penn Central framework, but it's difficult to do. Shortly after the Penn Central case in the early 80s, the court announced one exception to the Penn Central balancing test, and that was in a case called Loretto. Loretto arose on a set of facts in which the city of New York passed a law that allowed cable companies to enter buildings and install junction boxes for cables and cable TV. And the court held that when a government ordinance orders somebody to allow a physical entry onto their property, you look at the three factors giving decisive weight to the third factor, the character of the government action. And the character of the government action is concerning enough that it seems that the owner has suffered a regulatory taking and deserves some sort of compensation. But besides that one situation where the government uses a regulation to require the owner to suffer a touching, otherwise the Penn Central test, its three factors, apply to other restrictions on property, and especially regulations of the use of property, as you see in things like zoning restrictions, environmental restrictions, and preservation restrictions. About 10 years after Loretto, Lucas came down, and that was in 1992, 25 years ago. Lucas arose in a set of facts where an owner bought two beachfront lots in South Carolina. And a couple of years after he bought the lots, the South Carolina legislature passed a Beachfront Management Act, and the act barred any new construction along the coastline in South Carolina. Lucas argued that the lots he had bought were now useless to him because there weren't any structures on them. And he argued that he should be entitled to a taking under a regulatory takings theory. In a 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court held that Lucas had suffered regulatory taking, and it announced a second exception to the general approach of balancing under the Penn Central test. According to Justice Scalia's majority opinion, one strategy that Justice Scalia might have used is to look at the character of the government action and look at it and see whether the ends the government cited to preserve beaches were acceptable or not. He did not take that route. He said something to the effect of concerns about whether the government stopping harm or promoting benefits are in the eye of the beholder, and it wouldn't be productive to look at the purposes that South Carolina legislated for when it enacted the Beachfront Management Act. Instead, Scalia relied more on all three of the factors, saying that when somebody cannot do anything beneficial or productive with the land, that affects the way all three factors look. If you look at the economic impact of the regulation, it wipes out all valuable uses. The owner had some reasonable expectation of doing something, and the government action is troubling in the sense that a government action that takes all beneficial use is troubling, even if the government's acting for the commendable purposes of trying to preserve the beaches from erosion. And on that basis, Scalia held that when somebody can show that a restriction denies them all beneficial use of their property going forward, they've suffered a per se taking. Justice Scalia, though, announced one limitation on that holding. He warned that if a state regulation enforces background limitations on the owner's title, for example, a state law gives effect to what nuisance law and common law would already have restricted, then the owner doesn't have an expectation of doing something. He doesn't have an expectation of doing something that nuisance law would have barred him from doing. Justice Blackmun and Justice Stevens issued very strong dissents, but after the case, it was then understood that there are now two exceptions to the Penn Central framework, one for touchings, as in the Loretto case, and one for restrictions on the use of land that deny any beneficial use of land. And there was some later litigation that I'm sure the other contributors will talk about, but Lucas at least announced that second categorical exception from the Penn Central framework. And with that, I'll hand it over to Jim.
Thanks, Eric. So since Lucas has come down, there's been a great deal of debate as to whether this is just a little aberrational corner of the law for situations that rarely happen or if it is something of greater significance. So first of all, as a pragmatic matter, I would say it has had significance. It's actually had great significance for property owners because it set a line that previously did not exist, that regulating agencies today consciously will alter their policies to avoid a total take. Agencies such as the California Coastal Commission, for example, will, if they have rules and regulations that would otherwise prevent the use of a particular lot, they will say, we're going to allow at least one home on this property to avoid the total take. Now, if you have a large piece of property, one home may not be adequate for X number of acres, but it's a start. So at least the agencies are recognizing they have to give you something. They just can't leave some minor crumbs on the table. Like in Lucas, David Lucas still had the right supposedly to walk on his property and to pitch a tent on his property, but clearly all economic use had been destroyed and all economic value had been destroyed. Of course, there are a lot of questions that remain as to, well, how much do you have to leave a property owner in order to avoid a total take? Is it a question of having some value left to the property? Because in the Lucas case itself, the lower court had found that the property had been rendered valueless. They had agreed that it has no value left. But, of course, that's kind of odd because all property has some value. But if it doesn't have, and this is the point that I've tried to make in cases, that if it doesn't have, you know, economically viable use of some kind, it's really been effectively taken. The second thing about what is the practical implications of Lucas are that property owners, when they're bringing a claim for a regulatory taking, they'll often wrap these together. They'll bring a regulatory taking claim based on all loss of all use and value, but realizing that maybe a court will find that there's some use and value left in the property, so they have a backup claim under Penn Central. And this is a good litigation strategy to lead with a strong Lucas argument. So the court's going to say, no, we think you have some use and value left, but you've established that the deprivation under Penn Central, the economic impact, is great enough. It might not be so great as to be a Lucas taking, but it is certainly one of those factors that weighs heavily in Penn Central. And third, as with many of the other successful taking claims before and after Lucas, the sky has not fallen. That's language that the court most recently used in Horn. It seems that every time we have a regulatory taking claim of some kind or another going before the Supreme Court, the argument's made that, you know, if landowners are going to be paid for what government steals or takes from them, then government will cease to exist. The government will no longer be able to regulate nuisances. It will be no longer able to protect the public. And that's pretty much nonsense. I mean, frankly, regulatory taking cases are notoriously difficult to win. Many people bring them. Many fewer win them. And so it really has to be a fairly outrageous government action that either takes all use and value of the property that puts it into a taking, or is so egregious with the three factors of Penn Central that results in a taking. Fourth point I want to emphasize about Lucas is that its emphasis on background principles, I think, is its most enduring legacy. The idea that Justice Scalia talked about in Lucas that if you're trying to do something with your property that you could not otherwise do under common law of nuisance, then you don't have a right to claim for a taking. And that certainly makes sense. Because the examples he gave were building a nuclear reactor in a fault zone or building a dam that's going to flood your neighbor's property. Of course you don't have the right to do that. Your neighbor could go into court and enjoin you from doing that, and the government can pass regulations to do exactly what your neighbor could have done through an injunction. And that doesn't result in a taking of your property because you didn't have a right to threaten the neighborhood in the first place. But it does lead to a tremendous question of what is the nature of the property interest that we're talking about. And I have seen many cases where this essential question was pretty much avoided or ignored at the plaintiff's landowner's peril. I've seen taking cases arguing that a deprivation of a license is a taking, but the fact is that the terms of the license are that it doesn't have to be renewed. Or the right to smoke in taverns is a taking. Where's the property right there? There is one case even brought that saying the regulations on the distance between adult dancers and their patrons was a taking. Taking of what? Where's the property right there? Or mandatory union fees that were taken away after states passed right-to-work case laws. Those cases are still ongoing in litigation. The big question there is, what is the property interest? The other legacy out of Lucas is trying to define the relevant parcel, and this is something that's come up numerous times in subsequent cases, both at the Supreme Court level and at the lower court level. And by that I mean you have 10 acres of property, 1 acre of wetland. You can't use that 1 acre. Well, does that mean you just lost 10% of the value of the property? But what if that 1 acre was a separate parcel and it was buildable and in all intents and purposes it was a practically usable property and you can't use it? Or what if that's all you own? So the question of how much property has been taken oftentimes depends on what is the nature of the property, and that's an issue that's come up frequently, and it's one that the court really didn't answer in Lucas. It left that open as a footnote, and it talked about it and said, well, you know, it's not this question of having 95% of the value taken and or 99% or whatever the figure is, and you're left with a small percentage left. And the court said, no, that may go into a Penn Central test. But we really don't know what the parcel is. We don't know how much of the parcels can be taken. So there are a lot of questions left open after Lucas. But Lucas does teach the wise lawyer that to win any taking claim under Lucas or Penn Central, you have to understand what the nature of the property interest is. And Lucas left open probably many more questions than it answered. It has a narrow test as far as we're going to find a taking in these situations. where all use and value has been deprived, but everything else is still open. So it may come down to the fundamental question of what is the property that's being looked at, what are the nature of your background principles, and what can you and cannot do with a property. Those of us who have been arguing these taking cases for many years realize that Lucas is a nice signpost, but it really doesn't answer all the questions. And with that, I will turn it over to Michael, who will try to answer some of these questions. Michael Wolff.
Thank you, Jim. First, I'd like to thank the Federalist Society for the invitation to participate in this teleforum. I've had the pleasure of serving as a respondent in many Federalist Society events over the years at the University of Florida Levin College of Law, and I always find the programs provocative and the audience respectful of my views, even when they run against the grain, as I suspect they do today. I have 10 minutes, so I thought I would make 10 quick points about Lucas, a case about which I've been writing since 1993. Having looked back with some trepidation at what I wrote earlier, I'm pleased to say that I was not an alarmist then, a position that has been vindicated by the past quarter century. One, first point. In his 5-member majority opinion, Justice Antonin Scalia scored a significant political victory in the mini-legislature of the Supreme Court. According to Richard Lazarus's readings of Justice Blackmun's papers, Justice Scalia's per se approach pushed away Justices Anthony Kennedy and David Souter, who voted at first to join the majority. But it looks like the private nuisance discussion satisfied some of Justice Sandra Day O'Connor's concerns. This was a masterful stroke by a memorable justice, and despite the whittling away of regulatory takings law by the court in 2005's Lingle case, the Scalia opinion has endured the ravages of time and hostile commentators. Two, Lucas posed an ideological problem for Justice Scalia. As the opinion is overtly non-textualist, regulations are not takings. It's not originalist. Nobody seriously contends that at the time of the framing of the Fifth Amendment, the framers and ratifiers intended to use the takings clause this aggressively, or that this was the public understanding of the clause. And it's also non-federalist. That is, one could say that the majority was disrespectful of the Palmetto State's legislature and judiciary. But if one is looking for the high watermark of libertarian private property protection, it is certainly Lucas. Third, Justice John Paul Stevens's about-face became evident in Lucas. This Chicago conservative, the choice of President Gerald Ford to replace liberal firebrand William O. Douglas, made an interesting journey from joining Justice William Rehnquist in attempting to shrink the denominator in the Penn Central dissent, to writing the anti-Pennsylvania coal majority in the Keystone case, to becoming the strongest opponent of the notion of a regulatory taking as best represented by his attempts to discredit the theory in 2002's Tahoe Sierra case. So the case Lucas is significant because of the role that Justice Stevens played in his dissent. Fourth, Lucas is the quintessential rara avis, rare bird. The majority accepted at face value the state court's pronouncement that this was a situation involving a valueless piece of property. Plus, the court was faced with a statute that did not include a variance procedure. The first point was questionable, as pointed out by some of the justices who did not join the majority opinion and felt that Lucas's property did have some value. And the second point was resolved after the case began its journey to the justices, when the South Carolina legislature added a special use permit procedure. One can legitimately ask, in its haste to get a victory for private property rights on the books, did the court violate its prudential rules by rushing ahead to render a constitutional holding based on the, at best, second best constitutional clause? Fifth, in Lucas, Justice Kennedy attempted to situate himself as a fellow traveler with the more conservative private property rights champions. He emphasized that police power regulations affect the formulation of reasonable investment-backed expectations, and the expressed discomfort with confining the analysis to the narrow common law of nuisance. Justice Kennedy would repeat this pattern in his opinions in Eastern Enterprises, where he said it was not a taking, it was a due process violation. In Kelo, where he joined the majority with some reservations, and in Stop the Beach Renourishment, again, where he emphasized due process and not takings. I must admit to great curiosity regarding whether he and his former clerk, Judge Neil Gorsuch, will form a new dynamic duo in the takings area. Six, like Caroline Products, Justice Scalia's footnotes are as memorable and more influential than the text of the majority opinion. In footnote 7, he shows that conceptual severance, or shrinking the denominator of the takings equation, is not a dead issue, despite the discussion of parcel as a whole language in Penn Central. The Murr case, which is currently before the 8 remaining justices on the court, is one legacy of this footnote. Footnote 8 left a legacy as well, one bemoaned by private property rights advocates. As Justice Scalia seemed to equate deprivation of economically viable use with a total loss, if not at least 95% reduction in value. This means that most regulatory takings challengers have the very heavy burden of prevailing under the Penn Central default ad hoc balancing test. I believe that footnote 7 was a clever move and that footnote 8 was a strategic error. 7. The majority opinion is needlessly imprecise. Is he talking about economically viable use, whatever that means? Or is it economically feasible use? Or economically beneficial use? All of those terms are somehow used in this opinion. He also talks about something, a piece of property being economically idle. Is this a sign of too many cooks spoiling the broth or a blunderbuss approach? You can choose your favorite metaphor. 8. Lucas occasioned the rediscovery of nuisance law, a move for which this property treatise editor and legal historian is very grateful. Many critics of Justice Scalia's discussion of the nuisance exception have not read his words carefully. This is not 18th century law frozen in time. Moreover, I love that his two examples of background principles that would check a takings challenge, flooding and an earthquake fault under a nuclear power plant, were the subjects of two previous takings cases in the court, First English and San Diego Gas. I also love the fact that because of this exception, total deprivations are not technically categorical or per se. 9. The origins of South Carolina's Beachfront Management Act are attributed to government officials in South Carolina being concerned about, wait for it, sea level rise. The Blue Ribbon Committee that inspired the legislation stated, sea level rise in this century is a scientifically documented fact. The committee also relied on a 1983 EPA study predicting sea level rises of 1 to 3 feet over the next century. That study referred to greenhouse gases and global warming as causes for sea level rise. What a difference an industry-funded war on science makes. 10. Lucas is the opinion that launched 1,000 slips, that is, slip opinions. Lucas remains the major inspiration for the private property rights movement. It is the gold standard for taking challenges at a time when we don't have a real gold standard, which might explain why the Pacific Legal Foundation, the Institute for Justice, and other private property rights public interest law firms keep trying to expand the case's reach. If Lucas were given a movie title, it would be The Big Chill. This is not because so many decisions have found total deprivations, but because so many local and state lawmakers have hesitated to pull the trigger on arguably confiscatory land use and environmental regulations for fear of expending thousands of precious public dollars on a Lucas defense. Quality, not quantity, is important here. The Lucas legacy is large and enduring. And now back to Eric.
Thanks, Michael, I think. And this is kind of a strange setup because what's going to end up happening is that Jim Burling at the end of this is going to look like Goldilocks. Mike is going to have said that the Lucas case was too hot. I'm going to say it was too cold, and Jim is going to be in the position of saying it was just right. I am taking a position that, to the lawyers in the audience, I confess is an unrealistic one. I'm looking at Lucas as an academic, and I don't deny or dispute any of the many lawyerly or practical reasons why Lucas has been a constructive opinion. But as an academic, I like to see a body of law be coherent, and I like to see a body of law be up to the challenge that relate to the really important policy problems that the field arises or relates to. And I'm not sure that the regulatory takings doctrine does that. And in previous writings, I've been supportive of trying to reinvigorate regulatory takings doctrine using ideas from the police powers that were enforced on the court from about 1890 to about 1937. And this is the same spirit in which Richard Epstein wrote about takings in his book, Takings. And so let me give you a couple of thoughts why I take that perspective. First is, if we were looking at lots of other clauses that protect rights in the Constitution, we wouldn't construe them narrowly to say if we don't have a core violation, then we need to find specific evidence that some legislator or Constitution drafter specifically wanted the clause to apply to this. The free speech clause doesn't apply just to prior restraints, and the right to bear arms doesn't apply just to the government coming and taking your gun away. And the same ought to be true for property rights clauses, like the takings clause. And if one looks at practice, even though Lucas provides owners with some protections, there are lots of ways in which a government with the power to issue variances or a government that requires people to file for permits can sit back and bargain with owners, say, if you want the permit or the variance that you're asked for, you're going to have to do some favors for us on other grounds. And lots of those kinds of disputes are, I think, create situations where property rights are being unjustly restrained. But the Lucas decision does not give owners the kind of legal rights they need in order to complain about those situations. But then to have a more coherent alternative, one needs a coherent theory of the clause and a coherent theory of the Constitution. And to have a full-out theory of takings, one has to have a good theory of how the Constitution applies to property rights. And property rights mean not the right only to control, but also the right to use and the right to dispose. And I've written about this, but I deferred most to Richard Epstein in the parts of his book, Takings on the Police Power. You need a good theory of rights, and you need a theory of rights to explain when somebody does more than his rights allow him and then harms others. You need a coherent account of when the use of property creates harms, and the government can step in and say we're policing someone's harmful use of a property. From that perspective, I think that Lucas was a disappointment. Justice Scalia specifically said that distinctions between a government-enforced harms and benefits are in the eye of the beholder. And so for those of us who are trying to render a more coherent account of property rights in the Constitution and police limitations, he had contempt for those efforts. So the Lucas decision can be extended in an incremental basis in cases like in the Tahoe Sierra case where that argument was made and rejected. But in the end, an academic is worried that lawyers and people who are trying to get the law changed are going to do their best work if they have a good theory they're advancing. And I don't think people in the property rights movement have a great theory of property because they don't have a great theory about how property incorporates not only the right to possess but the right to use. And they don't have a good account of when somebody's exercising his property rights legitimately and doing so in a manner that's harmful to the government can step in. And I think I'll leave it with that, Dean. Back to you.
Thank you very much. I'm inclined to go through the order once more, but first let's open the floor to questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. So if you have a question for our experts, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got quite a bit of time left. We started on the half hour, so we've got 30 minutes left. Let me make a quick announcement while we wait to see who might ring in about our next scheduled teleforum conference call. That is tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern Time at this same number. We'll be talking about the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission and its cases that it has been bringing, alleging disparate impact age discrimination against businesses for recruiting on college campuses, as they are tending to hire more young people than not, I suppose. That's tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. Today, of course, we're talking about Lucas and the fallout from Lucas and what it might mean. Let me, if I could, we've got two questions pending. Just quickly touch back with Jim Berling and Michael Wolff to see if they have anything they want to add before we go to questions. Jim Berling.
Yeah, I want to add that, you know, I agree with Eric in many requests, many respects, and of course I disagree with Michael about much, but I'm just teasing. But I agree with Eric that we do lack a coherent understanding of what property is, and when you're looking at property that's been taken or not taken, that we have a lot of questions out there as to the extent to which the definition of property is affected by the regulations that surround the property. And we saw this a lot in the oral argument in the Murr case, where there were a lot of justices that were questioning whether the definition of property is affected by your investment-backed expectations. In other words, and there was confusion of whether that's a subjective or an objective test. So I would like to go further back to first principles and look at common law understandings of property as they have long existed. And your understanding of what your property right is and what your property right is not as much affected by the surrounding regulations as some people would like it to be. I think the property is more of a natural rights basis that you have the right to use your property in certain ways without creating a nuisance, as said in Lucas, but the whole gamut of regulations that somehow come into this and cause confusion, I would say we should try to avoid that. So yeah, I think we all would have loved it if Lucas were a more coherent case, but considering that Justice Scalia had to cobble together a majority and not lose too many people on the way, I think that's very difficult to do, because I think fundamentally a lot of the justices on the court then and on the court today don't fully comprehend or don't fully understand how they are not really following a traditional theory of property if they're going to say property is defined by the regulatory environment.
Professor Wolff, do you have something you might want to add?
Yeah, I mean, I don't disagree with both of these points, both of these speakers, that the court doesn't seem to understand property theory. The question is whether we should expect them to. If you look at the opinions in the Kuntz case, it's clear that that a lot of these justices, that there are stark differences in the way in which they situate a property case with regulation. My concern on the other side, and I tried to address this in an amicus brief that I worked on for the American Planning Association, the Murr case, is my concern isn't not necessarily that they don't understand property theory, it's that they don't understand land use regulation. They just don't, I don't expect them to. Not many land use lawyers or environmental lawyers make their way onto the Supreme Court. And so one of the challenges is to educate the court as to what the difference is between a subdivision regulation and a zoning regulation, the difference between a variance and a rezoning and so forth. And so, you know, I don't think we should ask too much of the justices. They function as I think as a super legislature at a very high level, and and to expect them to understand all the nuances. Look, to expect law professors to understand the nuances of land use regulation and property law is a lot. To justices who are concerned with civil and criminal law and a lot of different fact patterns, I think it may be asking too much of that body.
Can I add one thing, Dean?
Please go ahead, Eric Clays.
Just everyone in the audience, ask yourself, would you agree with what Mike said if you were talking about the justices having to get their hands dirty, learning how a speech code operates on a campus, or about the ins and outs of some religious display in a local government, or the ins and outs of some gun restriction or some police practice that affects people's rights to be free from unreasonable searches or seizures.
Very good.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to disagree with your point, Eric. I mean, I'd much rather have the protections of the First Amendment and maybe even the Second Amendment than the protections I get under the Fifth Amendment.
If you are in the audience and you have a question, push the star button and the pound button. Also, just a note that this call began at 1:30 Eastern time. Some people joined sort of at the top of the hour. I mentioned that the call is being recorded, so if you've missed the first part of the call, you can check for the podcast within 24 hours on the Federal Society's website. I want to get to the audience questions, but first, you know, Professor Wolf, you mentioned the Murr decision. Jim Burling, you mentioned Horn, the Raisin case, the takings case there. Let me just quickly ask any or all of you how some of these recent Supreme Court jurisprudence, what's the effect of Lucas been on Supreme Court jurisprudence most recently? Anybody want to respond to that?
Well, you know, let me start, Dean. This is Jim Burling, and because we don't have a decision in Murr yet, but the oral argument, a lot of it revolved around Lucas and the footnotes, as Michael Wolf pointed out. The footnotes are very important, both 7 and 8. How you define the relevant parcel, it came up as a big question. And that question of you know, how much property that somebody owns are you looking at when you're trying to decide if it's been taken, is something that was addressed in the Lucas footnote. It was something that was addressed and passed upon in Palazzolo. It's something that's been addressed in many, many lower court decisions, unsatisfactorily, I think. And it's now something that the court is wrestling with big time in the Murr case, because it's all about that. The Murrs own two parcels of property. They can use one, they can't use the other. So do you look at everything they have combined together as your denominator for a taking, or do you focus on the one lot they can't use? And that's a question the court's focusing on, and they're having a lot of trouble with it. The oral argument was not at all clear where they are. And you mentioned the Horn case. That's a case where all of somebody's raisins were taken, or all of the interest in raisins were taken. That was found to be per se. But you go to Sotomayor's dissent in that case, where she talked about Sotomayor, and it's not sure that she was getting it mixed up with Lucas in her discussion of that, because she was talking about cases where all use and value is taken away, all interest and property are hurt. So I think the legacy of Lucas is very much alive, and until the court clarifies it in some meaningful way, it's going to be alive for a long time.
Eric here. One decision that hasn't been talked about a lot that I think deserves consideration is the Tahoe Sierra case. There was a bi-state commission that was trying to clean up Lake Tahoe because Lake Tahoe was getting too much algae in it from fertilizers that were running with erosion into the lake. And the commission that was instituted imposed, a 32-month moratorium on further development while they studied what was wrong with the lake. And some owners tried to make an argument that they were suffering a taking under the Lucas per se theory for the equivalent of a 32-month lease. And the court held by a 5-4 majority in that case it was a 6-3 majority in that case that Penn Central continued to control. Lucas applied only in the situation where somebody suffered a total taking and a perpetual taking. That tended to signal that Lucas should be, like, in a closed case, Lucas ought to be read as the narrower of the decisions and Penn Central to be the more applicable decision. But as the Murr case shows, there are other cases on the bounce where you can make a good argument that that this is a Lucas case and not a Penn Central case.
Yeah, the only other case that I think that we haven't discussed, or maybe we haven't discussed others as well, is the Stop the Beach Renourishment case. So what Lucas does is, again, because of footnote 7 and footnote 8, or primarily because of footnote 8, because the majority just say that if it's less than total, it's going to be decided under Penn Central. That really is bad news for private property rights advocates, because it's really tough to win a Penn Central case. It's been done in the Supreme Court, but not very many times. And so these advocates have to come up with other theories. other ways to prevail under the takings clause. And the Pacific Legal Foundation made a very clever argument in Stop the Beach Remarriagement that got four votes. Three of those justices are still alive and on the court. And so I guess what I'm saying is that we've seen great creativity among litigators because Lucas was confined to total deprivation. So, you know, as I can't be an objective observer, but as an observer, I look at that and say, if the court had gone in the direction of Justice Brennan's dissent in the case called San Diego Gas, and I think some of our listeners might be surprised to learn that if you compare Justice Brennan's opinion in San Diego Gas to Justice Scalia's opinion in Lucas, the more ambitious pro-private property rights opinion is actually Justice Brennan's opinion. And the other thing is that the Loretto opinion was written by another very liberal justice, Justice Marshall. So if we had gone in the Loretto, if the court had gone in the Loretto San Diego Gas dissent direction, I think we'd have had a completely different landscape. But as it is, because of footnote 8 and because Lucas is confined to total deprivation, then there are two things that happen subsequently. One, you have to come up with creative ways of making a takings argument, like Stop the Beach Renourishment, which argues that there can be a judicial taking, not just a legislative or administrative taking. And you have to argue things like a 31-month moratorium is a total taking of a leasehold, is analogous to a take of a leasehold. So it has spawned creativity, I'll say that.
We've got two callers that have been patiently waiting with questions. Let's now turn to the first of those two.
Good afternoon. My name is Don Perdue. I'm a lawyer in the district. I really want to thank you guys for the panel. It's really helpful. And Dean, I also want to thank the Federalist Society for all the calls you guys have had kind of arising out of Mirrorview, Wisconsin. Don't stop. They're really useful. So here's my question, and it's kind of I have a little bit different take on Lucas as it gets used in actual trial courts. I represented a number of clients who are challenging the historic preservation statute in D.C., and the government has had some luck kind of using Lucas as an exception to Penn Central, but as a magnet, as it were, to pull the amount that the government has to take of a person's property higher up into the 90s, let us say, to, you know, even get a shot at the judge listening to what you have to say. So it in the trial situation, it's more like Lucas isn't an exception or a carve-out from Penn Central. It's pulled the level that you have to show as an advocate of a partial taking, because, you know, there's no full taking in a historic preservation case, higher. And I'd be curious what your guys' thoughts are on that.
Eric here. I think that proves that's exactly the kind – I agree with the observation you're making. That's been my sense of what happens in practice too. That, and maybe Michael was hinting towards this when he was talking about the San Diego Gas approach. If Penn Central had remained the only decision on the books and there wasn't this exception saying if you get to 99 or 100%, then you suffered a per se taking unless one of the background limitations kicks in, then maybe more court cases would be open to there being takings where there's a 75 or 80% deprivation, but not a high 90s one. I think there are some cases in which the impact can be lower and courts still find takings. I'm thinking of some decisions from the Court of Claims, but I think the generalization's right. But I think what the observation you're making is exactly my point, and I wanted to ask you to think about it this way. If these decisions were if there were to be disputes between two neighbors in nuisance or some other field of tort, the judge wouldn't be asking, okay, plaintiff, did you suffer a 95%+ harm? If you didn't, then get out of court, or I'm going to decide things on the basis of some other circumstances balancing. Instead, the court would conscientiously try to say, each of the people has a right And but the rights have to be understood as being correlative to one another, so you can't use your own in a way that inflicts spillover damage on somebody else. And it's very hard, it can be intellectually very hard to figure out when a nuisance has happened, and that's because it's hard to get rights right. But courts do set out some basic rules about pollution and the effect that pollution can have. And then once there has been shown to be a taking of a right, then they ask, well, how much harm did the plaintiff suffer? So the amount of the loss only becomes germane once it's been shown that there was a property right and the property right was taken by a tort of a nuisance. And the impact becomes relevant only at the stage of damages. And so when looking at something like historic preservation law, there were courts who looked at zoning restrictions and other restrictions on land use in the period like 1900 to 1930. And the thing they said is, we don't doubt that these restrictions on land use are beneficial in a sense. The communities make themselves more beautiful, but are they depriving owners of a liberty to do something? And are the owners in the course of doing what they're doing hurting anybody else right now? There's a difference between stopping your neighbor from doing something she wants to do and not surrendering the right to do something in cooperation with everybody else so everybody can create a common benefit. And if you're doing something that stops your neighbor from enjoying your equal rights, that's a taking of rights, and so the government is preventing you by police power from inflicting a tort on your neighbor. If you're refusing to cooperate in a broader government plan while still doing something legitimate on your own property, the government might create a public benefit by that, but that's a public use, and so you have to use the takings power. And so that's the way historic preservation laws ought to be treated. And in that approach, it shouldn't matter whether the person loses half the value, 20%, or 80% of the value of the land.
Yeah, this is Jim Burling, and I agree that the thresholds that we find in a lot of these Penn Central cases are disturbing, because you can have people that lose an awful lot of use and value of their property and still are not compensated for that loss. It's the old story that if a thief asks you for your wallet and he hands you back $20, have you been taken or not, or has anything been stolen from you or not? And I think there are a lot of reasons, and it's just not only Lucas, why we have this problem with thresholds. I think we were into having problems with thresholds before. We were hoping Lucas would improve that. It hasn't. Has it made it worse? I'm not sure. Because I think there's a reluctance of some courts simply to find government liability. They like these regulations, and they get convinced by very able practitioners and professors like Michael Wolff that, you know, if you're going to get rid of this land use regime, if you're going to change the zoning laws or find that there's liability for them, then people won't be able to zone, then you're going to have rendering plants built in the middle of residential neighborhoods, so on and so forth, which is somewhat hyperbolic. But the point is that courts are reluctant to find government liability in these cases, and they will find all kinds of ways to avoid it. So if you only have 50% diminution in value, that's it. If you have 75%, well, then you can throw in the character or the fact that, hey, you knew when you got this property that there were more regulations coming down the pike. You know that you had maybe wetlands and the regulations are going to get more severe. We've seen cases like that. So I think there's been just an unfortunate tendency of many courts, with the small exception of a few judges on the Court of Federal Claims, it seems, to find relatively high thresholds, meaning property owners lose an awful lot. And as a practitioner, like you, I get calls all the time from people that they have had a zoning restriction or a land use restriction or a permit denial or a permit, partial denial that really just destroys their plans. They were going to retire with this property plan. They were having all kinds of plans. These are small landowners, and now they get wiped out or almost totally wiped out, and there's really no recourse for them. And so I think it's an unfortunate tendency. I think that Brennan, his dissent in San Diego Gas and Electric, to me, shows that there should be more liberals joining the property rights cause, and I'd be happy to sign anybody up.
Michael Wolff, do you have anything on this point? We still have two questions pending.
I think I don't. I'd like to hear what the questions are.
Okay. I'm going to ask the callers to be as concise as possible. Go ahead, caller.
Hi, this is Bill Fischel in Hanover, New Hampshire. Hi, guys. How are you?
Hey, Bill.
Fine, Bill.
I have a question about the influence of Lucas, the ongoing influence of Lucas, and it's really whether you want to confirm or deny my or confute my impression. My impression is that Lucas has had a fairly important effect on the practice of granting zoning variances and the status of zoning boards in their variance rules. I have noticed over the last 25 years that I was on a zoning board, just to inform other people, I'm not on one now, that zoning boards in granting variances are getting more respect. Supreme courts of various states used to set very narrow parameters, and those parameters have been loosened. And I think, but I'm not sure, that one of the loosening factors is the influence of the Lucas case, where a total deprivation of economic use, I would emphasize the word use rather than value, could end up with a taking. And lots of zoning authorities are now behaving in what I call the baker's dozen mode. The baker's dozen, which is 13 equals 12, you give 13 when you're paid for 12, is a way of avoiding the extreme penalties for short-waiting bread back in the, sometime in the Middle Ages. And zoning boards are now trying to avoid getting into court. They are very happy not to be in court, and so they are more liberal in their granting of variances. Is this an impression? This is my impression. Do you share this impression, or do you think this is all just business as usual?
This is Eric jumping in. For audience members who don't know who Bill Fischel is, he's a very modest man who does not have a lot to be modest about. He's a professor of economics at Dartmouth who writes on property and especially land use policy, and author of the great book, The Home Voter Hypothesis. And no, Bill didn't pay me in advance to say any of this. It is a great book. My quick answer is that my general impression is that I'm glad you raised the point. It reminded me of one good feature of Lucas. I think some of what you're saying is right in that I think that the categorical rule it expresses is simple and clear enough that a city attorney can internalize it and explain to council members or a planning commission what its constraints are. So I think it has had some of the effects that you say. On the other hand, I think I think you're right also that encourages local governments to offer more variances or permits than they might otherwise have done. On the other hand, I think that they can give permits and variances that just do just enough so that they can say that the owner's not suffering a total wipeout, and that's enough.
This is Jim Burling. I agree completely with Eric and Professor Fischel. The local zoning boards do realize Lucas is out there, and they will try to avoid a total take by allowing you to make some use of your property. Sometimes it's not much use. Sometimes the use is inadequate to really pay back what you put into the property, but they will at least attempt to do that. As I said at the outset, the Coastal Commission has a policy of not doing a total denial, and they will say front out that we are giving you the right to do this on your property to avoid a Lucas take.
This is Michael. Bill, there were studies going back to the 1950s, and I think we've consistently found that, except in highly urbanized areas, boards of adjustment and zoning appeals routinely grant variances even when they shouldn't, according to the state standards. So I don't know how they could become more liberal. But, as I mentioned, one of the real problems with Lucas was that the folks in South Carolina did not include a variance procedure in their provision in their legislation originally. They then changed it.
Did they change it before or after the Supreme Court decision? I forget.
Before the Supreme Court's decision, but, while the litigation was going. Right.
Yeah.
That was highly unusual, and it was probably a really bad idea. I think that, I don't know if they're, I think they're just continuing past practices, and then maybe if some of them are aware of Lucas, And by the way, it's a great strategy. It happens to be a great strategy. It makes land use regulation takings proof to allow some development on the property.
Let's see if we can get our final question in. Go ahead, caller.
Hi, my name is Damus Anderson. I'm a GW law student. I'm currently writing a note topic on per se takings test and intangible property. And looking at the case law, it looks like most districts believe that the Lucas test only applies to land. And the ones who expand further than that only apply to personal property. No one has extended it to intangible property that I have found anyway. I was wondering if you guys had any comments on expanding the Lucas test to intangible property, whether or not it should be done, shouldn't be done, consequences, things of that nature.
I think that, I wish you luck on your note. you need to study the court's discussion in the Horn case, because they specifically address this question of Lucas and non-real property. Because there's a sentence in the majority opinion that was interpreted one way, and the court reinterpreted it in the majority opinion in Horn. So that could be a good starting point for you.
Eric, here, more than that, Horn mentions patents. I just pulled up Horn, and the court, it says, as this court summed up in James versus Campbell, 1882,
right.
A patent confers on the patentee an exclusive property in the patented invention, which cannot be appropriated or used by the government itself without just compensation. another case to look at is Monsanto's and Ruckelhaus. That argues that the order of the disclosure of a trade secret invades the right to exclude in the same way that a taking of land, like an invasion of, or occupation of land does. Pardon?
Okay, my mic is still on. So I've looked at both of those cases, and I have both of everything you just mentioned into my note, and yet I'm finding a lot of pushback in some districts who interpret those cases as, not Horn necessarily. I got to see how they apply Horn, but before Horn was out, the Monsanto case, they interpreted as an ad hoc test. There's a case, the Philip Morris case that I'm looking at right now, where the dissent was like, hey, Monsanto applies the per se test, and they take it in the majority take it in a different direction. And I'm having a lot of pushback from professors and people that I send my note to who just, they're like, no, there's no reason to expand this to intangible property. And I use the same lines you guys just used. And I'm like, well, look at this. I mean, this says you can do it. This says that it applies. And yet I'm getting pushed.
This is Jim Burling. As a lawyer arguing these cases, I think you're going to use any argument you can to advance your case. If I was representing somebody with intellectual property of some kind or another, you'd certainly want to raise all of these issues. And you can look also at Horn, because at the oral argument, I think, or it's in the decisions themselves, there's some discussion back and forth about Monsanto. Certainly in the briefs, Monsanto came up front and center. But you do have to understand that when you're dealing with intellectual property of various sorts, it's a very different sort of property than real property, even personal property, because there's a much more positive spin to the creation of intellectual property. It's government-made property in some respects, and you could argue that real property and to some degree personal property has more of a natural rights basis to it. So I think if you conceptualize the nature of the property you're thinking about, that might help you try to figure out when these precedents are going to apply and when they don't.
Yeah, in the same spirit, Eric Clay's here. It's important to think about the kinds of conflicts that precipitate different legal disputes. And when you're dealing with land, some government actions, especially in zoning, are meant to do things that look like nuisance, to deal with problems in nuisance law. And those are situations where one person's use is creating an actual physical interference with somebody else's use. And you're not going to have analogs to that with intellectual property. Instead, you're going to have something more like one person trying to use the same river water as somebody else when one person's trying to use the same idea that somebody else claims exclusive use of. And if one thinks about it, it's hard to figure out how different uses of one intangible asset are rival to each other, and that makes a lot of judges and lawyers skeptical that the cases from the realm of tangible property are going to map over well. There are ways to get around that, but one has to address those kinds of concerns that lawyers and judges are going to have.
Well, gentlemen, okay. I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it right there. We are, I would ordinarily say up on the hour, but we're up on the hour in terms of the length of our program. It's 2:30 Eastern time. So I want to thank all of you. This has been a very interesting discussion. I thank you on behalf of myself and the Federalist Society for joining us today. I want to thank the audience as well for dialing in and for your thoughtful questions. A reminder to our audience that our next scheduled telephone conference call tomorrow at 2 p.m. will be talking about the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission and disparate impact. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.